Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
Cole Hornaday.
Hey, Ben.
Hey, how's it going? And Chris Casso.
Hello.
Oh, well, how is everybody today?
Well, you sound a little bit froggy.
I got a bit flummy, like, right when I started, but I didn't want to have to stop.
My mind was wandering, and then I didn't hear you. I heard someone I
The eyes
I
just
knew.
Went and just yeah.
No.
Daggers
someone
into
I
the
knew
bed.
Long ago on a faraway beach.
I did that fancy engineering thing where as soon as I was done talking, really? I muted my microphone so I could clear my
throat. Clearly engineered my heart.
Yeah. All right. So, hey, friends, welcome. This is episode 150. I'm kind of fucking with the number these days.
Seriously, buddy, be careful. The death flu I'm going kinda around town right now is something
yeah.
to be feared.
I'm get your flu shots, people. I'm fudging the numbers these days because we're kind of recording out of order due to my screwy schedule. But this is January 22nd, 2018, and we want to talk about what is coming up at the Comics Dungeon.
So we actually just had a nice big remodel of the store. We got new shelves and expanded our kids section and expanded a lot of our sections. But specifically, we have a fundraiser to help send a school to go see Black Panther.
Oh.
And the details, I won't read this completely, but I'll read most of it, we were inspired by Frederick Joseph and Ryan Fisher to do our part in this. Mr. Joseph raised money to send kids in Harlem to the movie. I think he raised $30,000.
Yeah.
And Ryan Fisher, a local comic creator and artist, he reached out to us and thought maybe we could do something similar. So we reached out to all of the different grant recipients of C4C3. And we found that Mr. Albanes of Denny Middle School uses comics and graphic novels in his Proyecto Saber program, where students of color develop their cultural identity, interpersonal skills, academic skills, and college readiness. And it's an incredibly diverse population at the school, so we thought we should probably try and get as many of these kids to go see Black Panther as
Absolutely.
We could.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so we are raising funds at the store. You can come in and donate at the store, or you could donate on our website for c4c3.org, and so on and so on. And if you can't donate, please maybe just go share the links
mm-hmm.
yeah.
and
mm-hmm.
try and get some kids who might not have the opportunity to otherwise see the movie, go and see an awesome Marvel movie.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So you said that $30,000 was raised to send kids to see it in Harlem?
In Harlem,
yep. Man,
yeah.
How much does it cost to go see a movie in Harlem these days?
I get the
schools
feeling
are bigger.
Yes,
yeah.
And probably multiple schools if that's the
yeah.
scenario. I couldn't Excellent. Quite find that detail, but I just watched the same BuzzFeed video that everybody else watched. So.
So, yeah. Well, that's great. And that brings us to our first news topic, which is that early Black Panther ticket sales are outpacing all other Marvel films on Fandango. The previous holder was Captain America Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
Which had Black Panther in it.
Which had Black mm-hmm. Panther in it. I'm sensing a trend, friends.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah. But that's reported by Fandango. I guess they're the big dogs when it comes to pre-sales for movie sites. But yeah, go see Black Panther. Go take your friends.
There was an interesting one of the actresses in the movie attempted to get tickets after she kept pushing it, and she couldn't get tickets for herself.
Yeah, stuff was selling out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you'd think she'd get a screener since she's in the movie.
Yeah, I think she's the one to support it.
Oh, well.
So, yeah.
Sounds like it's getting plenty of support.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of opening slots that are already sold out in this city.
Yeah.
I know Cinerama sold out, so.
Cool.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, so moving on. A weak December puts 2017 comic shop orders down 10%. Mm. So did we feel that here? Was this was basically an industry-wide trend that December was so terrible?
Yep.
Yeah, and and in the article it said something like Marvel was like the lowest, or like one of the downfalls was that Marvel was so weak.
Yeah.
And I know that we have felt that as well.
Yeah, there's been a lot of stores reporting their numbers online, and a couple of the larger, more recognizable stores averaged about $20,000 short, I think, on Marvel sales. We were down quite a bit as well. And so, yep, last year kind of sucked.
And are we blaming that on Marvel?
A good chunk of it.
It's a it's an aspect of it.
Not entirely. No. Everybody suffered. DC suffered the least, it sounds like, in single issue drop off, but that's because of the rebirth stuff and because of events that actually like had people interested in them.
Yep.
I think a lot of stores reported that even all of their Image trade paperback sales were down quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they're still technically doing well.
Right.
So big dip no matter what.
And we've talked about on the podcast of an oversaturation. And I think in particular with Image, they were just pumping out so many more titles.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they've slowed down what they've put out, which is good. But I think people are still kind of feeling that fatigue and picking and choosing really carefully what they want to pick up.
Fatigue. And Scott pointed out to you that Image has kind of created its own problem with a model of a lot of readers buy the first issue because it's affordable, and then mm-hmm. they're like, oh, I like that enough, I will stop buying it and then just buy the trade because yep. the first trade will be $10 more often than not,
which is so, cheaper than buying the singles every month.
Yeah. Right.
Yep.
So
mm-hmm.
yeah. Yeah. So this article at Comicron.com, and I will link to it in the show notes, says that the industry has had fairly regular growth since 2001, with a misstep in mid 2011, and they're basically blaming the New 52.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And is that another, like, can we blame the comics sales dip in 2011 on DC's New 52?
I kind of feel like we can mostly, I'd have to go in and figure out some more specific numbers. But
I mean, New 52 failed so hard and consistently over time that they had to do something to pull themselves out.
I thought it was interesting that there's like this one event that tanked the industry.
Well, it was it did the opposite that they anticipated. It was they wanted to create a leaping on point, and it was a leaping off point.
Yeah, right.
I quit buying DC after that for years. Yeah. I was like so disgusted with the choices that they made, and I did not have any. I tried. I think I picked up the New Justice League, and I got couple issues in. I'm like,
nope, don't need it.
No, I can live without. Thanks for giving me this opportunity to leave.
Yeah. Do you remember what brought you back to DC?
I've not really ever come back.
Oh, really?
No,
it's only been like 7 years.
Hanna-Barbera brought you back.
Well, as far as like the DC superhero universe, I'm still pretty not interested. Yeah, there are DC books I read, but they don't fit into that continuity.
Right.
Like Snagglepuss, which we'll talk about later.
Okay. Did you have something to add, Chris?
I think I did, but my brain just dropped it.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway.
Yeah.
All right, it's cool.
I think I'm actually reading probably more independent books than I have in the past. And where DC's concerned, I think that, you know, I'm reading some things just out of spite because I want to watch, you know, sometimes you just want to watch something burn.
You're hate reading DC books?
Yeah.
Doomsday Clock? Absolutely, I hate reading that book.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, it's unfortunate that we can define the entire industry rising or dipping because of one of two companies.
Right.
But that is the nature of the industry, is that it's bolstered by these two pillars.
Mm-hmm.
Remind me later if I black out on the next episode, because I think I was going to have a whole thing about that when we were talking about diversity.
Right.
So unfortunately, New 52 jives with that being a problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Nothing we need to dwell on. I just thought it was an interesting little data point. Hey, friends, coming in January 19, Conan the Barbarian's coming to Marvel.
Woo-hoo!
And, it's apparently Conan is its own thing. Conan, Conan Properties International is the umbrella company that owns Conan the Barbarian.
Is that a recent?
That sounds recent, but I'm just thinking Conan Incorporated sounds great.
I'm going to read that comic.
A Camarian in every nation.
I'm curious how they're going to approach it, because growing up, I actually avoided the Marvel Conan comic book because I didn't care much for John Buscema's artwork. And it just seemed to be a regular monthly exercise in machismo. Mm. And it just didn't seem fun. But when Dark Horse got the rights and they started doing their version of it in 2004 with Kurt Busiek and Kerry Nord, Kurt Busiek writing it and Kerry Nord doing the artwork, and I think Tom Yates is doing the inks, I got so excited. I discovered a love for Conan the Barbarian that I didn't know existed. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things they did was they said, we're going to treat this, we're going to go back and look at the origins of this as a work of literature. We're going to go back and look at it as not just pulp fiction, but weird fiction. You know, that this, because this was, these, Robert E. Howard was a contemporary of H.P. Lovecraft and Machen and all these other weirdos that were like basically creating a literary genre. So Dark Horse did cool things like in the type font. In the comic book, it looked like an old Underwood typewriter. Mm. So you, like you were reading a cruddy old pulp with really lovely pictures. And it went that way for like close to 33 issues. And then I guess they decided, well, Busiek didn't want to write it anymore, which is really unfortunate. But I was so excited about Conan that I went and got all the collected editions of Howard's stories and was reading those and finally kind of getting my head around why this stuff has proven the test of time, because otherwise I just thought it was toxic masculinity run wild. And sadly, Dark Horse lost touch with what they were doing with that book, and Tim Truman took over, and there was an interim period where Mike Mignola wrote the stories, and they were okay. But when Busiek left, they quit treating it with that pulp fiction appeal, and mm-hmm. it just killed it for me. Absolutely killed it. I lost total interest. It started looking like a Marvel comic book, and I was sad. So whatever they do with it, it would be lovely if they approach it the way they did with Dark Horse, but I'm dubious they would try that.
My money's on Jason Aaron.
Yeah?
Makes the most sense for that character right now.
Yeah.
No details about who the creative teams are have been released or
if it was Aaron, that would be awesome.
There is a photo that has Conan standing next to Thor and Wolverine. And I think that's a little telling too, because it's proper Wolverine. It's not old man Logan. Mm-hmm. And it's modern Thor, but like maybe Thor's getting the hammer back. So it looks like they're going to maybe do an insertion of continuity
into the Marvel universe.
Yeah.
Well, there is that famous what if. There's that famous what if where...
Yeah, he became a pimp.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that was unfortunate. But hey, what else would he do? He was a freebooter. He was a sword for hire.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He wasn't exactly a moral person.
Politician.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so eventually he became a politician.
Yeah.
Marvel published 650 issues between 1970 to 2000.
Wow,
so in those 30 years. Again, no details have been released about who the creative teams are and whether or not they're going to be using legacy numbers.
Nah.
Wow. Yeah.
They won't. They need that. The sales of a number one.
Yeah. And I found myself constantly referring to him as Conan just because I'm so used to the late night show host Conan O'Brien.
I didn't want to say anything because I just liked thinking of Conan and Conan.
Mm-hmm.
Conan
the Barbarian.
What is good?
I always think of Conan the Librarian from VHF.
All right. So the Transformers animated movie's coming up. Power of the Primes. That was revealed at a couple of favorites of ours, Ron Perlman and Mark Hamill, who are going to be providing voices for this animated cartoon, which is a redundant saying. But, Transformers Prime Wars trilogy. Have you heard of this? I haven't even heard of this.
Well, so I think this is just part of the... Yeah. This is part of the Combiner Wars that they did. So the toys work on a system of, like, every year... It's a wave with a specific name and a theme. So there was Combiner Wars, and then there was Titans Return, and now we're in Power of the Primes. So this is them getting their corporate synchronicity up. The cartoons aren't that great. They kind of hurt me a little bit.
You're not such a purist that you welcome all Transformers properties
no.
to your bosom.
Mm-mm.
So I take it the
this is the no entry point for bosom. No.
How closely aligned then are the cartoons and the comics?
Not really much as far as plots go, but they're introducing elements that the comics made popular. For example, there's a Japanese toy called Overlord that never was in the American cartoons, and at least not the original stuff. And in the comics, they introduced him, and he's fantastic. He's like this really crazy kind of serial killer. It's like if Hannibal was a Transformer, and people really like him. So he just showed up in the cartoon, and it's like, okay, you're doing that. You know what's popular from one media, and you're inserting it where you want to. And then they made sure the toy was coming out, so you kind of got that feng shui happening, Transformer feng shui. So they pull certain elements over, but in like the most superficial aspects. Okay. Yeah. So yeah.
Yeah. And I started talking about this little bit of news as Chris and Cole were playing with. Chris has a Transformer dinosaur, and Cole's got, I don't know, what is that?
It's a dire wraith, Ben. A dire wraith. Yes, from ROM Space Knight.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah. So it was gifted to me before the show.
By the person that you were then battling.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Shows how grateful you are.
You don't want to put toys on the table with us. You know what happens.
All right. Here we go. Is that Grimlock? Is that who that is?
No, they made a new female Velociraptor to match the new Dinobots coming out.
Oh. What's her name?
Slash.
Slash.
Yes.
Lady Raptor.
I saw a cartoon. It was a Velociraptor equals Speed Raptor over Distance Raptor. All right, so moving on.
That's pretty great.
Guillermo del Toro won a Golden Globe for directing The Shape of Water, which was, it's notable because it is the first monster movie to have an above-the-line major award.
Mm-hmm.
So monster movie legitimacy, the yep. age of monster movie legitimacy ends or starts now.
We hope.
We saw it. Cole and I saw it together. Yeah. Have you guys seen it?
No,
I want to. Yeah. I went ahead and bought the soundtrack already. So, yeah.
it's fascinating. It's, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
It's a complete mise-en-scene in the whole film. It's this turquoise 1950s reality. I mean, the color palette was like one of my favorite things about the whole movie because the creature, Jones, who is it?
Doug Jones.
He has these bioluminescent turquoise highlights in his body that are just gorgeous. And so that was all part of the color palette. And I thoroughly enjoyed the characters and the depth of field in the cinematography and just the detail. Everything about it is just really rich imagery. And you know that he does that because you know you've seen Del Toro's films before. But I don't hesitate to say that this is one of the first mainstream successes for him as a filmmaker. I mean,
indeed.
He's made quirky, chilling horror films and of course the Hellboy movies and stuff like that. Getting people to go see Pan's Labyrinth out of the independent film circuit, that was a stretch for folks. And Devil's Backbone, unless you're a hardcore fan of his, you're not aware of it. Plus all the European and Hispanic horror films that he's produced that Nicole and I have braved the theater to see and
Kronos?
Suffered a great deal of disappointment. There's Kronos. Yeah. This is him at his... At the peak of his skill set. It's a beautiful film. Now I'm kind of like, are people going to rediscover the coolness of the Creature from the Black Lagoon after 50 years?
I hope so. I mean, he talked about in his acceptance speech how it's monsters are the patron saint of our own like human imperfections, I think is
yes.
how he phrased it.
The quote is, I believe are patron saints of our blissful imperfection.
Yes. And if you look back on the silent films, so the monster movies of like the 1920s, and later, there's a lot of depth to those movies, and they're really beautiful. And to be able to have that showcased in this way to a modern audience is really great because they're able to take on different subject matter, but do it in the light of it's the monster who's mm-hmm. the alienated person, and you
right.
know,
right. Because there's a big distinction. You know, there are horror movies as a general umbrella, but there's a big distinction between a monster movie and, say, a suspense film or a mad slasher film. See, I don't necessarily think that characters like Freddy Krueger are monsters. They're just a reflection of cultural psychosis. But there's a great deal of beauty to films like Frankenstein and The Bride of Frankenstein and The Creature from the Black Wolfman, because these
Phantom
of the Opera in particular, yeah, because these are very tragic, misunderstood creatures, literally, figuratively, you know, struggling to find their identity, to find a place. They're all postmodern romantic heroes in their own right, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and in many of these movies, the humans are the monsters.
Absolutely.
If we're really lucky, this movie being this popular will prevent them from making the new Creature movie as part of the MonsterVerse.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was in the lineup. That was in the lineup. Yeah. I think after Jekyll and Hyde or something, he was supposed to be next, but maybe...
Did they stall out after that awful Mummy movie?
I hope so. Yeah. It sounds like they're still going.
Okay.
But I don't know.
Man, just looking at the trailer for that one, I was like, oh, this is just gross and ridiculous. I'm staying away. And Tom Cruise. No.
There's just so much potential these days to really make something really great, but you have to not have, like, kind of the machine running it.
Yeah.
You need to have an actual creative person.
Well,
really,
and which should be Guillermo.
Yep. Yeah, and there was, most of the effects, help me out here, Ben, but I think most of the effects we saw in that film were all practical.
A majority of them, I would say. And if not, then they were done really, really well.
Nice.
Because the Doug Jones creature, that's, you know, that was a man in a suit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There may have been computer-generated elements to him, like his nictitating membrane over his eyes and that sort of thing. But, you know...
He had those surgically implanted. Method actor, that
Doug Jones is hardcore.
Well,
he trained his eyes for months.
He specifically got the power cosmic during Silver Surfer.
He had to retransplant them from his hands in Pan's Labyrinth back into his head.
That's why he's Guillermo del Toro's guy.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, I don't think we give old Doug Jones enough credit.
They signed a blood contract together.
Yes.
All right. And finally, today, it's been reported by comicbook.com that Brian Michael Bendis is going to be writing a backup story in Action Comics number 1000. Friends, tell me, what the heck is a backup story?
It's usually just like a short 6 to 10 page story.
Just in the back of the comic.
It's in the back of the comic book. Yeah. That's how that works. Yeah.
And usually with a number 1000, that means there's probably going to be at least 5 or 6 short stories.
Yeah. Probably. Yeah.
They're probably going to charge us $10 for this one. And there's going to be like a 20 page main story. And then all these little quickies pop up in the pinup gallery or something.
Yeah. But this will be his first
DC, maybe?
DC.
Allegedly. That's the report. Nobody knows for sure. It's anticipated to be released in April of this year, 2018, to also coincide with Superman's 80th anniversary.
Mm-hmm. My goodness.
No, Superman, he doesn't look a day over 35.
Mm-hmm. No. Not when you keep rebooting him.
Young jeans.
He does. He's got those good Kryptonian jeans.
And he's got a good skincare regime, you know? Mm-hmm. It's really important.
It's that cold weather in the Fortress of Solitude.
He's been watching those beauty bloggers, you know. Would you say it's hyper time?
It's called hyper time.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
Beauty by Mark Waid.
Yes.
Well, that's the news that we're talking about today. So let's move on to Book Report. And Chris Casso, let's start with you.
So Image Comics, every once in a while, they've only done it twice now. They send an advance edition of a special book that I think they're really excited about. I think the first one was for Afar.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that was a complete graphic novel.
And they released a complete graphic novel as a preview edition.
Yeah.
With like not as great paper stock or something like
that. It was like tinier.
Tinier.
It was like digest size.
So they did a advanced trade paperback for the new Robert Kirkman series called Oblivion Song, and they're allowing retailers to read the first 4 issues of this monthly title ahead of time. So that's really handy. It gives me an idea of how I want to order it. The plot to Oblivion, Robert Kirkman with art by Lorenzo De Felici. The plot is that apparently 10 years ago, a chunk of is it Pennsylvania or Pittsburgh? One of the P's. A big city got teleported and or disappeared and replaced with a hellscape and monsters. And people didn't realize until like years later that everybody that disappeared got teleported to another dimension and had been living in hell that entire time. So the main character is a guy who mounts these expeditions where he teleports into the other reality and finds survivors and teleports them back home. But it's been 10 years since that happened, and the government's cut his funding, and he's trying to prove, like, there's still people there. There's still hundreds of thousands of people there. And so the whole series is about him struggling to still do that job while trying to get government funding and finding different types of survivors, maybe some people who don't want to come back or some people who've been horribly damaged by this experience. It's an interesting read. It's actually one of the first Kirkman things I've actually been interested in is scripting for a while, because he gets kind of dull for me, a little stiff in his scripting, and this one was a little bit livelier than usual. And I did really enjoy the first chunk of stories here. There's some good, interesting character development, some world building, and just good package all around. So I will recommend the series when it starts, which I think starts up like in a month or so. And I don't know if it'll be as popular as any of his other books, because, you know, Walking Dead number one goes for how many thousands?
$1,600.
Yep. And
blue
even
metal.
Thief of Thieves goes for like $40, even though nobody pays that. But you might want to grab a number one and take your chances, and it might be worth something, but it'll actually be a good read.
Cool.
And so, you can pre-order that now,
yep,
because that's available to pre-order.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
All right. Oblivion Song. Just offhand, does Kirkman still pen all of The Walking Dead, or does he hand that job off to others?
It's all him.
Yep. He's still writing it.
Wow. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, he doesn't pass the buck on anything. So,
cool. Yep. Quality stuff. All right, Cole Hornaday, what do you got for us?
Well, I think I'm going to team up with Nicole Lamb on this one.
We're the Coles.
Yes. So,
all right, friends, what do you got?
One of the one of Cole's most anticipated, eagerly anticipated books of the new year, which is... did I say that wrong?
Nicole or Cole?
Well, I know. I don't know. I'm not going to speak for you, my darling.
Okay.
But yeah, this is Mark Russell and... Mike Feehan's Snagglepuss Chronicles. You know, I'm a super duper fan of Mr. Russell's take on the Flintstones. Mm-hmm. So when I read the press information that he was going to do his version of Snagglepuss, the pink mountain lion, as an effete playwright a la Tennessee Williams in 1950s New York, I just went bonkers. Nicole?
Also as a closeted gay man.
Is a closeted gay man who actually frequents the Stonewall.
The Stonewall, yep.
The Stonewall Tavern,
mm-hmm.
The famous, where the Stonewall riots originated in the 1950s. So, do you want to say anything about the book?
How about you take the leads and I'll add some additional commentary?
Well, this book does not disappoint. The only thing that's disappointing about it right now, I can tell you from a distance, this is only going to be running 6 issues. But now I have some forewarning, so I won't be blindsided like I was with the Flintstones.
I had the same reaction with Deadwood.
Did you? I'm sorry.
I didn't know it was coming to an end.
But I wept real tears, Ben. It's
who are you?
Unlike
to judge
your fake tears. You splashed water on your face.
Like tears and rain.
The first issue is a wonderful arc that has an evil conclusion, and I'm not going to give it away. But in a mere 32 pages, Russell successfully encapsulates the 1950s New York glitterati. Snagglepuss was a fan. He grew up reading the. Not the New York Times, but the New Yorker, and the writings of all the members of the Algonquin Round Table. And we learn that he is friends with Dorothy Parker. A side note that's happening is, of course, the Rosenberg trial. There are a lot of historical figures that weave in and out of the story that touch him in some way or another. And as I was reading it, I'm like, you know, this is... There's a reason why I did our most recent panel jumper about 1950s horror comic books, because this post-war era of the United States is not only reflective of what we're experiencing right now, but was probably more insidious because things were so much more under the surface. We have Snagglepuss, who's leading a double life as a successful Broadway playwright, but he's also got like his faux wife who makes public appearances with him, but he actually has a secret lover named Pablo. Right? Is that his boyfriend's name?
Maybe.
And meanwhile the Senate Subcommittee on House Un-American Activities is happening. The Rosenberg trials are happening. So all of this anxiety, paranoia is just percolating all around him, while here is this very effete, well-spoken gentleman, Southern pink mountain lion, making his way through life as best he can and not letting a snappy one-liner get past him or anyone else.
That's really good.
Thank you.
Also, there's also the discussion of his career, and he's really hot right now, but, you know, how long is that going to last? Because
exactly.
He also has friends who have been that hot person at one point, and now all their leads have dried up, and they're kind of a has-been.
Or so, they've been blacklisted.
Or they've been blacklisted,
yeah.
So there's this fear of, you know, the witch hunt that's going on, and them, him getting found out and his career and all that.
Yeah. I think it's a fascinating book. It's tapping into what I feel is I've always felt it's a very fascinating part of American history. And it's also dealing with theater. So, hey, I'm going to recommend this book. I will probably spare you a review of each issue. I may just, you know, tell you how I feel about the conclusion when that sad day arrives, but I recommend this book. It was a lovely read. It's great fun. This is another one of those books that reminds me of the potential of the comic book storytelling and why I stick with it.
Yeah, I mean, for what it does well. I think you just have to want to go in with that in mind. I mean, I think if you liked Flintstones, I think this almost hits you over the head harder with what it's doing, but it's still in the same vein. So I don't know that I'm going to keep up with it necessarily.
Oh, shame on you, Nicole Lamb. Shame on you.
It's more of a mood thing. I don't know if I want to be hit over the head with this, but I think that it is very well executed.
Well, you know how thick my skull is. I'm also reading his Prez.
I'm
three quarters of the way through
it.
It is, Prez is pretty nasty. It's pretty biting social satire under the surface, and Snagglepuss is on a par with that.
Yeah.
I think Prez.
Yeah.
I could have reviewed Prez, but I was going to review this instead. Also,
makes
I haven't
sense.
Finished reading Prez yet,
right.
But I think Prez is pretty brilliant and pretty spot on. So,
yeah. Yeah, so I think if you've liked his other work, you should pick up the Snagglepuss too, right?
Run to the comic book stand. Run! Get your copy of Snagglepuss Chronicles number one.
They did not really keep the number one issue very readily in stock. The distributor.
Really?
It is not
There's
easy
no second
to
print offered
and
at the moment.
I haven't seen a second print, so I hope it does pop up because I feel like it's been something people have been waiting for a while.
Yeah.
It was delayed because I thought it was originally supposed to be out September of last year, and it's January.
I think it threw people off because there was the little bit that was in the other Hanna-Barbera DC crossover stuff.
Yes.
And then everybody's like, this is a thing, and then this didn't happen until so much later.
Yep.
A lot of people who thought it was going to be a thing forgot it was going to be a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So then they're being reminded, and now we don't have any. Hooray!
Was the limited first run intended to create value?
No.
No, I think there's just like an, you know, some sort of...
I don't think DC's taking risks on some of their print runs.
Exactly.
And if you sell out of stuff, it gives you something to be like, look, we're popular.
Right.
You know, you can release that press statement and say, second printing's coming out. We're only printing 300 of those. You know, so.
Exactly. Something like Metal, the Dark Knight's Metal series that's currently happening, they have been doing new printings of, but I don't know that something like Snagglepuss, even though it probably would sell in new printings, if they're going to take that chance and put that out. So we'll have to wait and see. So
I'm sure they have like a cost threat analysis kind of thing.
Exactly.
You know, cost risk. I like cost threats.
I like, I went with that. That sounded right to me.
But Snagglepuss is really good.
Yes.
All right. So
that means it dies faster.
Thumbs up on Snagglepuss from Cole. Nicole, you like it, but you're not going to continue reading it. Probably.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Too many other things to read.
Right.
That I'd rather read over it. But
cool.
But I don't think that it's a fault of the comic, even though Cole is getting really sassy silently over there. But yes.
All right. So for my book report today, I tend to just pick a couple things and just read them. Mm-hmm. I don't cast my net wide. Mm. So one of the first titles that I bought from the Comic Extension when we started doing this show was Descender Volume 1, because I think you had a store variant cover.
Yes.
And I don't think I had that one because that was kind of a scarce thing at the time. Mm-hmm. But so I'm going to talk about Volume 2 of Descender from Jeff Lemire and Destin Nguyen. Volume 2, Machine Moon. I thought it was... Oh, let me just give you a bit of a backstory on the story in case you don't know, because everybody here knows everything that I read because I'm so late to the party all the time. But it's a... basically a war between robots and humans. These robots called the Harvesters came just out of nowhere one day and basically just started killing people. And so we pick up the story about 10 years after that event, where there are like separate factions, robot and human factions, and there are humans called scrappers that go around and basically hunt robots and kill them and turn them in for money. And so we meet this young robot boy, Tim 21, who wakes up after 10 years and he goes looking for his old companion, Andy. And meets up with, like, the creator of the robot algorithms and this humanoid type alien Earth lady whose name is Telsa, but I keep reading it as Tesla. I don't know why. and I had to remind myself what happened at the very end. And here's the thing about Descender: it's drawn in this very, like, Destin Nguyen has this very beautiful, like, watercolor art style, which at times is really hard to follow what's going on in the picture. Mm. And for someone who doesn't like read comic books pretty much, you know, like, as a regular thing, I had a hard time like telling my eyes where to go in the book. But in this one, Tim 21 has met up with Tim 22 and some other people, and they're basically on the run from a bunch of scrappers. One is on their tail, and there's a reveal. I think this has been volume 5 is on the shelves. So the reveal of this one scrapper who's really trying to get Tim 21 is his old companion Andy, who has teamed up with this big beast of a thing. It's one of my favorite characters. His name is Blugger Vance, I think that's what his name was. He's a really sassy talking alien. Yeah, Blugger Vance, which kind of confused me because there's a Robert Redford golf movie called The Legend of Bagger Vance, and I thought maybe there might have been a connection there, but it's not.
Now I want to see a golfing movie starring this guy.
Yeah, man, a golfing movie starring this guy. But, I mean, the splash pages are really beautiful, and the volume 2 goes through... Andy remembering his first, like, when he was a kid on this mining colony where his mom was a miner, and they get pretty much taken. Yeah, I guess kidnapped's a proper word, by some bots, some robbies, they call them, and taken to the secret hideaway on an asteroid where, you know, they set up Volume 3. So, and it's another thing about like casting my net deep into comics and not wide. I feel the need to just like get all of them and read all of them because I've already started.
Yeah.
This is the completest in me. This is why I collected baseball cards when I was a kid and not comic books, because I'm like, if I start at one place, I got to go all the way to the very end.
Right.
So I'm probably going to do that. And I'm not hate reading it, but I feel like I'm reading it out of sort of like obligation.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean to say that I don't like it.
Okay.
But I'm not really like drawn in yet.
Okay. Because what you could do is just get them at the library so you're not spending money on it.
This is true. They're not that bad. It's 15 bucks.
But also you could re-gift them too if you felt like you didn't want to hold on to them, right?
Exactly.
Because you have plenty of people you can give comics to.
I have more of those people in my life every day. It's like I said, it's really beautiful. It's, you know, you can see the texture of the paper, which I think might be like an unusual thing in comics these days. At least it is for me, for the few that I've read.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff Lemire is definitely telling a story, and you know, part of me wants to see where the story goes, but then there's that also other part of me was like, well, do you really want to know where the story goes, or are you just doing that because it's your
personality type.
Right.
Anyway, so Descender Volume 2, that was my book report. And now, let's move on to quiz time, everybody. And but before we do that, I want to tell you that the Pergabound Podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, as well as the Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford. We're 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Find us on iTunes or however you get your podcasts at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. And now, friends, get your quiz hats on. It's quiz time. And this week, our question come to us from Mr. Chris Kso. Lay it on us, Chris.
So since we talked about The Shape of Water, I made a creature-centric quiz time.
Excellent.
And first question is kind of a long one, sorry. The creature's designer made huge contributions to the horror genre that have been largely forgotten even by diehard fans. Her talents were numerous. She acted in 21 films, drew concept art for countless others, performed as a concert pianist, and became the first female animator that Disney ever hired. Before Creature from the Black Lagoon, she'd sketch various monster body parts for Universal. The Gilman gave her an opportunity to really shine, as she was responsible for designing every inch of the creature's body. As part of the film's ad campaign, she posed with Gilman masks and sketches for some publicity shots, but makeup artist George Hamilton Bud Westmore, you know he's a douche because he has that many parts of his name, didn't want to be upstaged. He falsely claimed that he was the beast's sole designer and made sure that her name stayed out of the opening credits. Who was this prolific creator who unfortunately didn't get her due credit?
Oof.
No. Millicent Patrick. She's fascinating if you get a chance to read up on her.
Yeah, I actually read a couple articles on her. Because it was very heartbreaking to discover that this lady had done all these things and has been forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She may have also been like a Contessa or something like that. So there's a lot of interesting stuff there. Next question. When Boris Karloff retired from playing Frankenstein, this actor took over from 1944 to 1948 and terrified audiences in Universal's House of Frankenstein, House of Dracula, and Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. Years later, the studio tapped him to play their web-footed Gilman in Creature from the Black Lagoon, but because swimming wasn't his forte, he declined the part. Who was this?
Oh, I'm going to kick myself for not knowing this. And once you say the name, I'm going to be like, oh, of course.
Of course.
Okay. It's not Boris Karloff, because...
No.
I'm not going to talk.
Glenn Strange.
Glenn Strange.
Oh, of course. I actually didn't know who this was.
They perfect. Know all this. Yeah.
Referred to as the Gilman in the 1987 movie The Monster Squad, the creature, along with the Wolfman, the Mummy, and Frankenstein's monster, were recruited by Count Dracula to assist in taking over the world. For its appearance in The Monster Squad, the Gilman was redesigned by a famous makeup effects designer in order to merely suggest Millicent Patrick's original design due to licensing issues. Who was this designer?
Wasn't Stan Winston, was
yep.
it? Yeah!
Stan Winston, who's best known for his work in Terminator, the first Jurassic Park, three Jurassic Park movies, Aliens, the first two Predator films, Iron Man, Edward Scissorhands, and more.
Pumpkinhead! Pumpkinhead!
He did everything. In 1993, Dark Horse Comics adopted the creature from the Black Lagoon in a single prestige format book for just $5. Who was the creative team behind this faithful adaptation?
Quantity.
Art Adams and Terry Austin?
Yes, written by Steve Munkus as well.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah.
It's wow. Man, if you can find that, it is absolutely gorgeous.
You don't have to pay much for it either.
No, and it's really cheap.
Yep. Yeah. In Alan Moore's League of Gentlemen series, a tribe of creatures from the Black Lagoon are responsible for killing infamous Nazis Martin Bormann, Joseph Mengele, and numerous clones of Adenoid Heinkel, their Adolf Hitler stand-in. So if you needed another reason to like the creature, there you go. They have an instinctual desire to kill Nazis. Which installment of the League books did this occur in?
The first.
I could just guess.
Nemo, River of Ghosts. The last in the Nemo trilogy. Last question. Doug Jones, who played the Gilman in The Shape of Water, of course also played Abe Sapien in the Hellboy movies. He's known as the leader of the Gentlemen in the Buffy episode Hush, the Fawn in Pan's Labyrinth, the Silver Surfer, and a slew of other cool monsters and aliens you've seen on TV and in the movies. But few people realize he also played a popular McDonald's ad mascot in the late 80s. Who was this mascot?
Ronald McDonald?
No.
Is it the purple guy?
No.
The Hamburglar?
No.
He had to be super tall. Who is the super tall guy?
Grimace is the only one, but he's
no.
a purple guy.
Yeah.
No,
think, Mayor McCheese.
No, think Late Night.
Late what?
Late Night Advertising.
Oh, the Moon oh, Man. He was the Moon Man.
Mac Tonight.
Oh.
Wow, I forgot about that.
Known for his crescent moon head, sunglasses, and piano playing, Mac was portrayed by Doug Jones in his first Hollywood job ever.
That's awesome. I had no idea.
Yeah.
I'm thinking McDonald's After Dark? What are you talking about?
The timing on that came up so funny because I was making these quiz time questions, and then I took a break and started just going through Tumblr, and that picture of him with like the mask just pulled out, and I'm like, that Doug Jones? And I started reading up on it. It's just like, yeah, okay.
Nice.
All right. Nice cool. work, Mr. Jones.
Well, thank you, Chris, and thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.